From WBUR Boston and NPR, I'm Jane Clayson in for Tom Ashbrook, and this is On Point. The Egypt Air crash is raising new questions about security at U.S. airports. It all comes at a time when the Transportation Security Administration is under criticism for those long lines at the nation's airports. Chicago, New York, Los Angeles. Across the country, passengers are forced to wait in security lines for hours before boarding their planes, if they haven't already missed their flights. This hour On Point, sky-high tensions for the TSA and the challenge of keeping airports safe. You can join us on air or online. Have you gotten stuck in these long airport security lines? Is it worth the wait to feel safe? Do you think you are actually safer? Join us anytime at onpointradio.org or on Twitter and Facebook at On Point Radio. Later this hour, UN Ambassador Samantha Power's message for the class of 2016 at Yale College: invest yourself fully, get close. We'll have that later. But first, joining me now from Washington is Tom Costello, correspondent for NBC News, covering all things aviation. Great to have you, Tom. Thanks for being here.
Nice to be here, Jane.
So as we go to air, Tom, give us the latest in the search for the Egypt airplane.
Well, it's a frustrating search, as you would expect. This is somewhere in the neighborhood of 180 miles or so north of Alexandria, Egypt. And as you know, they have discovered some debris on the surface of the Mediterranean Sea, including what they believe to be human remains and possibly pieces of the plane. The big challenge is going to be honing in on the black boxes. There is an underwater pinger attached to the flight data recorder. That's critical because, of course, the flight data recorder contains hundreds, even thousands of bits of information about the performance of the aircraft. So they'd like to find that, not only to get the data, because where they find a black box will probably be the location, of course, for the rest of the wreckage. The challenge here, of course, is that this is 10,000 feet deep, and that therefore they need to have high-tech equipment to listen for those pingers and then hopefully move in towards those pingers. Singular. That is challenged as well because you've got multiple layers of cold water, and as you go through these different temperature variants in the ocean, that can distort the pinger sound. In other words, it's almost like an echo effect through a canyon. So multiple navies in the area are said to be operating submarines, including Egypt, although the other navies we're hearing through the grapevine, they don't want to confirm where their nuclear subs are operating. Ultimately, you may also see the Egyptian Navy bring in what's called a towed pinger locator, and it's the name describes exactly what it does. They drag this behind a ship, hoping to pick up the pinger. And they've got about 3.5 weeks left of battery life on that pinger, assuming that the cold water doesn't drain the battery even sooner. Mm.
Egypt's prime minister says that all possibilities are on the table as to the cause of what brought that plane down. But as you say, until we get those flight data recorders, it's just speculation, Tom.
Well, we do have some bits of information here that are really confounding, I will tell you, to the experts. And as we reported on Friday, there was a data burst transmission from the plane. It's called an ACARS data transmission, Aircraft Communications Reporting System data. It literally is an automated system from the computers on board to the maintenance base. And what that came out was we had reports of, from that data burst, a warning coming off of a window in the cockpit of a heat sensor, two of those actually, and at the same time smoke in the lavatory, the forward lavatory. And then about a minute later, smoke in the avionics bay, another alarm coming from the window, a heat sensor, and then eventually we had flight data and control computers failing. So that's it. Then it stopped. So the question is, why was the ACARS data transmitting that to the base? Was that a signal of an explosion on board or a fire on board or both? And then why did the plane continue to fly for a couple of minutes after that? We presume on autopilot before going into the water. There's also an awful lot of bad reporting out there, errant reporting suggesting, you know, theories that most pilots deem to be really not credible. Mm.
Still a lot of information needed. So has the Egypt air crash prompted an increase in airport security in Europe and here in the United States?
Certainly in Europe, although Charles de Gaulle Airport in Paris is saying they already believe that they are at a very, very high level of security and did not feel the need to tighten it anymore. Here in the United States, we saw LAX increase their performance at the LAX PD as in terms of perimeter security and trying to close down even more of the doors and the access points to the airport perimeter. Other airports are suggesting that they are already standing on as high of a security profile as possible. You know, I will tell you that over the years, the attitude in the United States has been that our airports already are at a very high level of security that the rest of the world needs to emulate. Now, veteran travelers may not always agree with that, but that kind of is the position from not only airports in the United States, but also Homeland Security and the TSA.
Well, the head of the TSA said that the Egypt Air crash is, quote, a stark reminder of the need for tough airport security. This comes at a time, Tom, as you well know, when the TSA is facing a firestorm of criticism about those never-ending security lines at airports across the country, for one thing. Give us a sense what's going on with the TSA.
Well, you're absolutely right. And to make this point, to drive home the point that you're making and that Jay Johnson made, the Homeland Security Secretary, if this turns out to be a terrorist attack, and that's a big if, it would be the seventh time since October the terrorists have brought down a plane using an explosive device or attempted to bring down a plane. We had the Metro jetliner over the Sinai back in October that was, according to most U.S. intelligence agencies, as well as the Brits and the Russians, that was a bomb. And then we had another one in February of this year. A bomb blew a hole in the side of a plane over Somalia. That plane thankfully landed safely, and now we've got this incident. So this reiterates and reinforces this notion that, of course, aviation is a very big prime target for terrorists overseas. Now, here in the United States, to pick up on your point about the TSA's problems, the TSA admits they are understaffed with a big capital U, somewhere in the neighborhood of 5,000 fewer TSA officers than they had about 5 years ago. What happened was the TSA was betting at the time that more and more of us would be signing up for TSA PreCheck. Mm. That is the process by which you submit to a background check, they clear you, and then you can go through expedited screening. You keep your shoes on, your light jacket on, you can keep your laptop in your purse or in your briefcase or what have you. That didn't happen. Significantly underestimated or overestimated how many people would be signing up for PreCheck. And so as a result, you don't have nearly as many people going through TSA lines. Through TSA PreCheck, the TSA understaffed dramatically their checkpoints, just as we have record numbers of people now traveling thanks to a very good economy. So at the moment, we've got 2.2 million people traveling every single day by air in this country. Compare that to an average of 1.8 million or so last year. And now for the summer, a projection of 2.5 million every single day. And there are so many elements to this story. And the TSA can't hold on to enough staffers. They are losing 119 every week. 119 quit every week, just as they try to graduate 200 every week from the academy. So you can see this is a losing game for the TSA. It's going to take them forever to catch up.
You say more passengers are coming in the summer. The TSA is actually warning passengers that security wait times are going to get worse. Here's a bit from ABC News speaking to travelers at airports across the country in the wake of the Egypt Air crash. Travelers seem to be understanding of the long security lines, at least here.
You know that you got to wait in line for a while.
Just try to not get frustrated, upset, know people are doing their jobs.
I mean, I'd much rather that they're careful and do the necessary checks than something happens.
And here, passengers reported spending upwards of 2 hours trying to make their way through the TSA security checkpoints at O'Hare in Chicago last week. NBC 5 Chicago spoke with passengers there.
Well, I flew for an airline for a long time, and I have never seen anything like this. This is just, somebody needs to get their act together.
So last Friday, Tom Costello, the Department of Homeland Security, the TSA, they laid out a 10-point list of line-cutting strategies. Tell us what they're talking about.
Well, some of these are the same points they've been making for a long time. They want more people to join TSA. They say that they're going to try to bring dog teams into TSA lines, and that's an important point because they believe that there is no better detection vehicle out there than a dog with that nose. And if they can run the dog through a TSA line and be confident that nobody has any explosive residue or explosive on them, then they can push that entire line through expedited screening. In other words, they will not insist that that line takes off their shoes and their coats and what have you. And so they have great confidence in dog teams. They're trying to push dog teams from smaller airports, for example, Maui. Literally, they had dog teams in Maui. Push these to, for example, Minneapolis and Chicago O'Hare. I was actually there at a Chicago O'Hare last week, and I saw these lines, and they were unbelievable. But as soon as the dog team came in and ran through that line, they were able to move that line through much faster. And at one point, the line stretched, we thought, an hour and a half. They brought the dog team in, and the line was moving in 15 to 20 minutes. Mm-hmm. So that really does work. By the way, I think I may have misspoke a few minutes ago when I talked about the number of terrorist attacks on planes in the last 7 months.
Okay.
It would be three successful attacks in 3 months. I think I may have said seven, but three in 7 months.
Okay, good. To your point, your last point, Secretary of Homeland Security Jay Johnson promised that the TSA would soon add more personnel and those canine teams to help reduce wait times at airport security lines.
We're asking the American people to be patient while we bring on the added resources as quickly as possible to alleviate the wait times. And we are asking the public to have the appropriate expectations when they arrive at the airport.
Tom Costello, what is the average wait time now? And do you know what percentage of passengers are actually missing their flights because they're stuck in security lines?
Well, those numbers are hard to come by. Listen, here's the thing. It depends on the airport. It depends on the time of day, right? You can show up at Washington Reagan Airport and be through security in 5 minutes. You could then get stuck in a 2 to 3 hour wait at Seattle SeaTac or in O'Hare or in Minneapolis. That really depends on the time of day, whether you're getting there just when they have a push of people. And we all know that there are these, it ebbs and flows at every airport across the country. So I think that, you know, the challenge is going to be for them to push the resources to the right airports at the right time.
This is On Point. I'm Jane Clayson in for Tom Ashbrook. We're talking this hour about the challenges facing the TSA and passengers in the wake of the Egypt Air tragedy and as summer travel season heats up. You can join the conversation. Are you looking at the long airport security lines and thinking maybe you'll just drive or take the train? Airport screeners, tell us what you go through, what you see every day. Tom Costello is with me, aviation correspondent for NBC News. Tom, before the break, we were talking about the percentage of passengers who are actually missing their flights because they're stuck in these long security lines.
Yeah, but thank you for reminding me. So it's hard to get an actual percentage, but I'll tell you that American Airlines really has been the only airline to be upfront on how big of a problem this is for them. And they are telling us that tens of thousands of their passengers have missed their flights since the first of the year. So if you then consider, well, listen, one of the worst hit airports is Atlanta. We know that. And we know that Delta really is the predominant airline in Atlanta. You can imagine they're having significant problems. This is really across the country. So I think we're, you know, safely talking tens of thousands of people since the first of the year across all airlines have missed their flights.
Mm. Tom Costello, stick with us. Let me bring in another voice here. In Connecticut, Democratic Senator Richard Blumenthal, he authored a letter sent to 12 major U.S. airlines urging them to stop charging bag fees this summer. Senator, nice to have you with us. Thank you for being here.
Great to be with you, Jane. Thank you so much.
So you sent this letter encouraging the major airlines to eliminate the bag fees. You want to encourage people to check their bags, get rid of all those carry-ons. The Department of Homeland Security, Jay Johnson, has asked the airlines for the same thing. What's been the response?
The response so far has been negligible. We've heard from two of the airlines who have rejected our proposal. I made this suggestion, along with one of my colleagues, Ed Markey of Massachusetts, as the evidence shows at those checkpoints where there are no fees, there are 27% fewer carry-ons. And so the way to lower, can't eliminate it entirely, but reduce the number of carry-ons and thereby expedite screening is really to create an incentive for more checked bags. Mm. And it's also a good thing for security because, number one, it means that these bags are screened by a different kind of x-ray, but also you have fewer lines and fewer soft targets for extremist violence, which we've seen in Brussels.
See, I'm reading otherwise here. Airlines say that encouraging passengers to check more bags would actually exacerbate screening issues, that at places like Chicago's Midway Airport, served predominantly by an airline that doesn't charge bag fees, wait times there are in excess of 90 minutes. They say that further demonstrates that this problem is really not about bag fees.
If I had to believe one source or another, I'd believe the TSA rather than the airlines, because they make a lot of money, in fact, $3.8 billion last year alone. I'll repeat that, $3.8 billion from these check bag fees. And it stands to common sense that if people don't have to pay to check their bags, they're going to do it more often. And what I'm seeing, and I think a lot of folks are seeing it as well, is that people who intend to carry on their bags find when they board the plane, there's no room for them. And so they have to be checked anyway, which further delays the boarding and takeoff process. So I think the airlines would be well advised to give up a little bit of that $3.8 billion so that there are fewer lines and fewer delays and fewer missed flights.
So you bring up the $3.8 billion. TSA has a $7.4 billion budget. Congress has approved another $34 million. Several Republicans say the issue is with the TSA. It's not about shortage of resources. Here's Florida Congressman John Mica. He's been a longtime critic of the TSA. Here he is at the House Oversight Committee on May 12th, chastising the organization for its failures.
You cannot recruit, you cannot train, you cannot retain, and you cannot administer. It's just a huge failing government program, and it will fail.
John Mica there from Florida. So, Senator Blumenthal, is this an administrative issue? Is this a funding issue? At the core, what is this?
Jane, here is the most important point to understand. There is no one solution. There's no panacea or cure-all. It is a combination of answers to your question. Representative Mica has a good point. There needs to be better management. And I have pressed the TSA, in fact, met with the TSA administrator, Vice Admiral Peter Neffinger, just last Thursday. And he is actually of the same mind that there have to be improvements in management. There's no organization that can't be improved. And he is determined at each airport to make sure that the best management practices are applied and to recruit better and to train better. But Congress bears a part of responsibility and blame for this issue. Congress cut TSA's budget, and so the number of screeners was reduced by about 5,800. Mm. This $34 million will enable hiring of close to 760-plus new screeners, but that pales in comparison to the 5,800 that have been reduced. So the $34 million compared to $3.8 billion in profits or the $7 billion in the total TSA budget is a drop in the bucket. Mm-hmm. And so Congress must bear its responsibility, do its job, and make sure that some of that funding is restored. But the bag fee issue is not irrelevant. And the airlines have to do their part in assisting as well. And
Senator Blumenthal, let me bring in another voice to the conversation. From Prescott, Arizona, Richard Bloom, aviation security specialist and chief academic officer at Embry-Riddle Aeronautical University. Nice to have you, Richard. Thank you for being here.
Well, thank you very much, Shane.
So what do you hear in this conversation with regard to the TSA?
Well, what I'm hearing is how TSA might become more efficient. We also could have added the fact that there have been whistleblowers within TSA who have been poorly treated, that certain commercial airports have opted out of using TSA screeners. But the real point has to do with security and aviation terrorism. The history of aviation terrorism real briefly goes back to the late 1920s, and people have tried to deal with it in multiple ways way before there was any TSA at all. So I think the larger issue, the more important issue, is how you actually implement appropriate aviation security, and that involves having layers of security, both people and technology, matching the risk that you get from collecting and analyzing intelligence information, and that often doesn't get talked about as much as we can. And one further point that often doesn't get communicated as well, there's a huge psychological issue. Terrorism ultimately is psychological in nature. The targets are not the people who are injured or destroyed or the things that are damaged or destroyed. The real issue would be the people who observe and find out about it through the mass media. So ironically, we're talking about these issues, and using the mass media actually facilitates the psychological impact of aviation
terrorism. So talk more about that psychological issue, because you've said that there are a lot of security measures in place that don't necessarily decrease the actual likelihood of an attack. So people may feel safer, but they are actually not measurably safer.
Well, in my opinion, having looked at this for many years now, there's a certain element of the visible posture of aviation security at an airport that really is to reassure the public, and that becomes ironic because the public is getting angrier in how long it takes to actually get through and get on your flight and things of that sort. But what should be happening is that moment by moment, your layers of security, the people you're using, the technologies you're using, should be changing as the risk changes in terms of a threat from terrorism or other kinds of aviation security violations as well. That's what needs to be talked about in terms of how TSA can better deliver, or doing away with TSA altogether for some other kind of capability.
Tom Costello, as threats evolve around the world to this point, is the TSA evolving with them?
Well, I think that's one of the reasons why yet another reason why these lines are so long. You may recall a year ago they suffered a 95% failure rate when undercover inspector general teams tried to smuggle mock explosives and weapons through checkpoints. 95% failure rate. As a result of that, by the way, which was terribly embarrassing for the TSA, they decided they had to tighten things up dramatically, and they put an end to just waving anybody through the pre-check lines. They were kind of doing this what they called managed inclusion approach to security, which said they would have behavior detection officers and other TSA officers kind of watch the crowds and pick people out who they thought looked like they were not a threat. I mean, literally kind of doing a little bit of profiling, not necessarily racial profiling, but profiling of individuals, and said, okay, this little old lady with blue hair does not need to go through the full TSA pre-check. So they would put her and others through pre-check. Well, after they suffered this 95% failure rate, they decided we can't do that anymore. We've got to start putting almost everybody back through normal TSA checks. Now, there are some exceptions, but for the most part, they're trying to put everybody through the full security and upping their game at the security. So, you know, when we talk about why are these lines so long, you've got multiple reasons here, from morale issues, which are terrible at the TSA, to the terrible problems with failing their inspector generals. I mean, it just goes on and on and on. And on top of that, record numbers of people traveling.
Let me get some callers in here. I've got them lined up. First, Delay in Atlanta, Georgia. Hi, welcome to the program. You're on.
Hi, Jane. Hi. Thanks for taking my call.
Yes.
I am actually flying out of the Atlanta airport tomorrow.
And good luck to you, Delay.
I know. Well, I was thankfully able to upgrade myself to business class, since it's a business trip, and hopefully that will shorten the process. But I hear the guests talking about the problems with TSA, and I feel like there are some peculiarities here in Atlanta, too. They actually shut down the South security access point for improvements or something, which just led to the mayor firing the manager of the busiest airport in the country. And so that doesn't really give us a whole lot of confidence as travelers here in Atlanta.
Delay, thank you so much for your call. Certainly each airport has its own issues, as we're hearing. Mike in Iowa City, Iowa. Mike, welcome to On Point.
Hi, thanks for taking my call.
Yes.
I just wanted to speak out in favor of the individual TSA workers. The organization as a whole, I think, does need to upgrade and improve their processing and probably administration and management. I'm a relatively frequent traveler for business, and the lines frustrate me as much as anyone, but the individual TSA agents have an incredibly hard job. They bear a great amount of responsibility. They take the blame if something happens. They deal with people who are frustrated, and I see people, you know, exhibiting very rude behavior to them. They have to take all that with professionalism, and I don't think they get enough credit for what they do.
Mike, thank you. Glad you called. Glad for that input. Senator Blumenthal, let me go back to you on Richard Bloom's point about posture. I think he called it the posture at the airport, trying to make people feel safer, putting things into place that make people feel safer, in fact, making them more angry.
One point that is worth making, first of all, to second what your most recent caller said, TSA employees deserve credit for grace under pressure. They deal with people who are frustrated, angry about to miss flights, with children, bags, and so forth and so on. And by and large, they do pretty well in keeping their composure and their balance. But they deserve better equipment to do their job, and so does the traveling public. There are new equipment, more automated screeners, which also may be better for security, that are being implemented all too slowly right now, and the cost would be negligible compared to those budgets that we cited earlier and the $3.8 billion that airlines make from checked bags to equip the 20 busiest airports with this new equipment would cost, the TSA estimates, about $30 million. Mm. So there is an example of a specific, concrete way of improving security. After all, as Tom Costello said, there are multiple reasons, and security has to be the paramount goal here. We all want to travel safely, but we, in some sense, we are using 20th century equipment for 21st century travel.
So there's the issue of new equipment, but Senator, there's also the talk of privatization. I mean, many airports are threatening to replace TSA screeners. Here's, let's see, this is NYPD Commissioner Ray Kelly speaking with Fox's Maria Bartiromo last Friday, talking about privatizing airport security. He says it would be a bad idea.
I don't think you can have private entities, the airlines themselves, controlling the flow of traffic.
They would be more vulnerable than government.
I believe so, ultimately. Just, you know, notionally, they would be. I mean, they're good people who try to do a good job, but I think you need a government entity to do it. I think they need more resources.
Richard Bloom, can airports hire private security contractors?
Well, the real issue is not public versus private or government versus business or anything like that. There are empirically validated approaches to educating and training people, giving them the right morale and esprit de corps and feeling that what they're doing is special. That can be delivered poorly or well, whether it's by government or by private entity.
Senator, do you agree? Is privatization the answer or not?
Privatization, I agree totally, isn't the answer. I will repeat, at the risk of belaboring the point, there is no one magic solution. In airports where there has been privatization, for example, San Francisco, there are lines as well. And it really is a question of management, not whether it's private or public, but better management, more resources, not only for screeners, but equipment, and also protecting whistleblowers. People who complain, whatever we want to call them, should not be victims of retaliation. That is a very, very important point. Security ought to be the paramount goal, but there are ways to reduce the lines and eliminate the frustration that people feel when they carry on bags and they find the bags won't fit on the airplane because so many people are doing it. The more carry-on bags that can be checked, the less the lines will be, and that's one reason why I've advocated eliminating the fee. But there's no question, Investment in training and equipment and management all have to be part of the solution.
Tom Costello, the senator, brings up these whistleblowers. We've got about 20 seconds here. Three of them testified on Capitol Hill. What happened there?
Well, absolutely right, and they raised a long list of issues and arguments that everybody seems to agree the TSA's got to deal with. They've got a terrible morale problem. I would leave on this one point. Almost everybody on both sides of the aisle have high praise for the current TSA chief who inherited this mess. Admiral Neffinger is now trying to clean it all up. Mm.
Tom Costello, thank you so much for being with us. Great aviation correspondent for NBC News. Appreciate your time, Tom. Thanks.
My pleasure.
Senator Richard Blumenthal, thank you for being with us. Democratic senator from Connecticut. Appreciate your time, sir. Thanks.
Thank you very much, Jane.
This is On Point. I'm Jane Clayson in for Tom Ashbrook. We're talking about airport security in the United States and the efforts to make them more efficient and still safe as summer travel season kicks off. You can join the conversation. What's your solution? Have you signed up for PreCheck? Do you think the system should be privatized? We're speaking this hour with Richard Bloom, Chief Academic Officer at Embry-Riddle Aeronautical University. And here's some sound from Tuesday's episode of CBS's The Late Show with Stephen Colbert. Stephen Colbert joked about the state of America's airports.
Anybody traveling this summer? Anybody? Yeah. No, you're not. Because thousands of passengers are missing their flights right now due to airport security lines that last for hours. Travelers are weary, angry, dirty, sleeping in chairs. Basically, America's airports have become America's bus stations.
A lot of reaction online here. Audrey says, honestly, at this point, a terrorist wouldn't even have to try to get through security. All they would need to do is approach the crowd of people waiting. Todd says, the problem is that TSA has zero incentive to speed up the screening process. Solution, abolish the TSA and hand airline security back to the airlines themselves. That way, each airline would have a vested interest in the speed and effectiveness of the whole boarding process. The government doesn't care if you make your flight or not. Todd, thank you. What do you make of that, Richard Bloom? Is that, abolish the TSA, hand it all back to the airlines themselves?
Well, again, there's a minor point and a major point. The minor point is what to do with TSA, whether we need it, how we can make it more efficient, and all of that. The major point has to do with how to do aviation security. And the three main issues there, one, what combination of people and technology do you need? How do you match that against the actual risk from terrorism and other threats to security? And the third psychological point, how do you communicate and manage information so fewer and fewer people will want to engage in terrorism or support it, and fewer people will be psychologically affected by it. It really is extraordinary that so many people feel fear and anxiety and all the rest when there's a terrorist attack, even when that attack is unsuccessful, like the underwear bomber, the shoe bomber, and all the rest of it. People seem to have a notion that they need 100% safety when that's not possible. That's exploited by people involved in aviation-related terrorism.
Let's get more calls in here. Kathleen in Nashville, Tennessee. Hi, Kathleen. Welcome to On Point.
Thank you. I have a little bit of a different story. I was flying last night from Albany, New York, through BWI to my home of Nashville, and we had a one-hour wait, which in Albany is quite significant, usually 5-10 minute wait. But it wasn't because there were not enough staff, as we were being told. There was plenty of staff, and they were all behind the one person checking tickets. Pre-TSA was closed. Priority boarding was closed. And the frustration I have is hearing you say the dogs are going to increase decrease the wait time, mm-hmm. And push people through the pre-TSA line. What about those of us who have paid for our pre-TSA are finding more and more that they're closing those lines? And a place like Albany, where it wasn't a staffing issue, but when I went to my airlines to let them know that there are people who are not going to make their flight, and they didn't, we're told that that TSA is very upset at the Albany airport, and it almost seemed like it was a work stoppage issue. Thank you.
Kathleen, thank you. I mean, you're hearing this more and more, Richard Brown, these pre-check tickets, these pre-check lines. You pay $85, 5 years, you get to skip the long lines. In fact, those lines are closed, too.
Well, you know, you have an expression about missing the forest for the trees. If we focus too much on how to make an entity like TSA more efficient, we miss the major point of how do we have better aviation security, how terrorism becomes less effective, how fewer and fewer people will want to engage in terrorism, and fewer people will be psychologically impacted by it. It may turn out as we continue to study how terrorism occurs, especially in an aviation context, TSA may not even be the right answer to that threat, but if it is, how it can be managed much differently. Again, if we get too hung up on how quickly you get through to your flight, we miss the major issue going back to 9/11 and going back to the history of aviation terrorism in the late 1920s.
Hmm. Orna in Madison, Wisconsin. You're on the air. Welcome to On Point.
Hi, thanks for taking my call.
Sure.
So My question is, it seems like the TSA is very reactionary. I mean, somebody puts a bomb in a shoe, and then we all have to take off our shoes, or someone brings a liquid explosive, and now we all have to put them in 3-ounce bottles. But I've traveled to Israel many times, and I've never had to do anything like that. And they obviously know a lot about airline security. They've been dealing with terrorism for decades, and they haven't had any kind of incident since the 70s. Is the TSA looking at how they do their security to try to get some ideas?
Orna, thank you. Richard Bloom, what is Israel doing that we're not?
Well, it's really interesting. Right after 9/11, there was an influx of Israeli aviation security experts and terrorism experts to this country, working with our people in intelligence and various security organizations to up how we deal with anti-terrorism and counterterrorism programs. So that certainly is going on. A related point, however, goes to the global nature of aviation-related terrorism. Every day there are people who engage in reconnaissance and surveillance, and they watch how security violations are handled at airports throughout the world, and that information goes into aviation terrorism planning. Even beyond that, in any 24-hour period, there are a number of security violations at airports, intentionally, unintentionally. That information is also collected and goes into terrorism planning. So it's almost as if all this free experimentation is going on, giving information to aviation-related terrorists. And certainly, there are people in this country, in our government, in private entities as well, who are aware of that as they try to develop better counters.
Mm. Well, a lot of ideas out there. Orna mentioned what's going on in Israel. There are suggestions here about the kind of crowd control and line management techniques used at the Disney theme parks, a fast pass of sorts, which Canada says it's already using with some success. Is that different from PreCheck?
Well, I think the point here, again, is not whether you have pre-check or not, or how quickly people get through an entry point or a gate or anything of that sort. The real issue has to do with what exactly is the nature of the risk from terrorism and other threats to security. Mm. Once we know that, we match that to all the different ways you have uniformed and people out of uniform who engage in security activities like the behavior detection systems, which, by the way, are not empirically validated and seem to be very ineffective. Also, what choice we have for explosive detection systems and trace systems and facial recognition systems and all the rest of it. It's matching all these security choices with the nature of the risk. That's what's crucial. And if we continue to have a TSA, that's what TSA has to better focus on.
Let's get Sharon in here from Janesville, Wisconsin. Hi, Sharon. Welcome to On Point.
Hi, Jane. Thank you.
Sure.
Your previous guest, Senator Blumenthal, suggested checking your carry-on bags. And I carry on a bag because I want things that I may need in it if my bag is lost.
Right.
My clean, you know, so I'm just thinking probably the majority of us do that for that reason.
But what about those baggage fees, Sharon? $30, $50 a bag, whatever it may be. Do you pay it? Do you get mad when you pay it?
I don't want to pay it because I want to carry on my bag.
Okay. Sharon, thank you. Let's get Leslie's opinion here from New Orleans, Louisiana. Hi, Leslie. You're on the air. Welcome.
Hi, Jane. Thank you.
Sure.
I have the opposite opinion.
Okay.
I think that if you carry on your bag, you should be charged and maybe even go through another line so the TSA can focus on people with just small bags. You could bring your toothbrush and a change of clothes, a small bag, but not these big bags, and they should reverse the charges on charging the bags and have screening, and the bags would be separate, and they could be screened separate. And then if you just have a purse or something, you go through a separate line and you don't have to pay.
All right, Leslie, thank you. Liz on Facebook says, whether you pay for the bag or not, the FAA allows one bag and one personal item. Want to get rid of the problem? Change the carry-on allowance. Tom in Albuquerque, New Mexico, you're on the air. Welcome.
Yes, Jane. Just a quick statement. After all of this, talking about lines and stuff, why do we not at all encourage train travel? It's much more comfortable. The seats are wider. You have restaurants on the trains, lots of baggage room, and the lines are short.
Take care of the problem. Tom, I hear you. Hansa Online agrees with you. My solution is don't fly anymore unless I have to cross an ocean. I'd rather drive than be treated like a herd of cattle. That's what I've been doing for the last 5 years, and I travel well over 10,000 miles a year. So, Richard Bloom, what needs to be done here? I mean, is it possible that there is an easing up on security measures? We go the other way in order to make these lines move faster, in order to make some efficiency happen?
Well, I think there are two main points there. Point number one, in terms of how much you take on the aircraft or how much you have to check, to be somewhat insensitive about it, all you're trading off is whether the terrorism-related explosion will occur in the passenger area or in the cargo area. The bigger issue is security itself and how much you know about the nature of the risk. And I think that's really crucial. So it all goes back again to not necessarily how efficient TSA should be or any other entity, but how much do we know about the actual risk and what we're willing to do about it, what limitations of our everyday personal liberties and freedoms are we willing to give up. And I think that's really the crucial point, especially psychologically. Again, are we willing to tolerate a certain degree of risk? Are we willing to tolerate living in a world where we should choose to act the way we want and live the way we want, knowing that there are people out there who aim to harm us? And that's a whole different way of thinking about things.
Let's get Erin in here from Boston, Massachusetts. Hi, Erin. Welcome to the program.
Hi, Jane. I just wanted to say I couldn't agree more that it's a management issue. I flew through Philadelphia last week, and it was a mess. Had nothing to do with the time it takes for us to get through the security, but there was no central manager. They were letting TSA people into the general line with no explanation. And I think that, you know, it's going to take as long as it takes to get people through safely, but if you felt like there was a manager and things were moving as efficiently as possible, it would cut down on people's feelings that their time is being wasted.
Erin, thank you so much for the call. So Richard Bloom, final thoughts here, about 30 seconds to go. Some airports offering live music, free snacks for passengers waiting in long lines. What are your thoughts about balancing efficiency, customer service, security?
Well, certainly we want to be as efficient as we can. We want people to enjoy the experience of aviation, which is a very, very safe mode of transportation, by the way. But ultimately, in the world we live in with global terrorism and various threats to security, it really comes down to an intelligence question. The best we know about who means to harm us and how they plan on doing it, the best we can develop layers of security that will be both efficient and effective.
Richard Bloom, joining us from Prescott, Arizona, aviation security specialist, professor and chief academic officer at Embry-Riddle Aeronautical University. Richard, really appreciate your time. In a moment, UN Ambassador Samantha Power tells graduates at Yale to get close to make a difference. This is On Point. Yesterday, UN Ambassador Samantha Power addressed graduates at Yale College Class Day in New Haven, Connecticut. Her message was to go all in and to get close. Getting close, she said, means moving beyond approaching an issue through the screen on your laptop or phone or the filter of someone else's interpretation, and instead finding a way to get to know the individuals whose lives are impacted. She described how she did this after graduating from Yale, first as a journalist and then as a diplomat.
To really get close to an issue, you must seek out ways to see the world and its problems from a radically different perspective from the one that comes naturally to you. This is hardly a new challenge. For example, a previous Yale Class Day speaker lamented the fact that, quote, we subject all facts to a prefabricated set of interpretations. We enjoy the comfort of opinion without the discomfort of thought, end quote. That was John F. Kennedy in 1962. But the problem has only become worse. From the Facebook and Twitter feeds we monitor to the algorithms that determine the results of our web searches based on our previous browsing history and location, our major sources of information are increasingly engineered to reflect back to us the world as we already see it. They give us the comfort of our opinions without the discomfort of thought. So you have to find a way to break out of your echo chambers. This is tougher than it sounds, especially when it comes to the issues you care most about. But it is in your interest to engage the people you disagree with rather than shutting them out or shutting them up. Not only because it gives you a chance to challenge their views and maybe even change them, but also because sometimes they may just be right. When I started as the U.S. ambassador to the UN 3 years ago, I made up my mind that since I wouldn't be able to travel to every country in the world, truly getting close, I'd at least try to visit as many ambassadors from the 192 other UN member states as I could. I decided that I didn't want to go into the meetings with a set of asks, as I normally do. I just wanted to get to know a little more about the issues that mattered most to them, how they had become diplomats, what books and keepsakes they had brought with them all the way from home, and the art and photos they had chosen to put up on their walls. So far, I visited the ambassadors of 164 countries. The ambassador from Zambia told me how HIV/AIDS had ravaged her country. A pediatrician before becoming a diplomat, she said that at the peak of the epidemic, she could hardly rally herself to go to work in the morning because, as she put it, there was nothing I could do to help my babies. But she cared too much to quit. At the Cuban mission to the UN, which I was the first U.S. ambassador to visit in a half century, photographs of Che Guevara and Fidel Castro still line the halls. The ambassadors of many small island nations have told me about witnessing climate change transform their countries in their lifetimes, seeing the villages where they grew up completely flooded. One of these ambassadors brought the stakes home to me recently and unforgettably. He said, "I just don't know where all of my people will go. Who will take us?" Now imagine if you live on a small island state. Imagine what that means and what your future looks like.
That's UN Ambassador Samantha Power speaking to graduates at Yale College Class Day yesterday. For a video and transcript of her address, go to our website, onpointradio.org. I'm Jane Clayson, in for Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point.